Jeffreys wanted a perfect child, healthy and intelligent. His 6-year-old son was like that. Bright, athletic, talented, strong. The baby Amanda was carrying would not be so. It's a rather minor defect, the doctor had told her after his examination at the Hell Medical Center. The somber expression on his face said it was worse than minor. Thank God that the genetic screening revealed it. We can prepare for it and take steps to control his condition. A minor genetic defect. The baby would be born with a form of chronic anemia. It can be controlled with proper medication, said the doctor, trying to reassure Amanda, or we could replace the defective gene if you choose to undergo the procedure. They could operate on the fetus while it's in my womb, Amanda was told. But that would mean a major medical procedure, and I'd never be able to keep that secret from Martin. Just getting the genetic screening tests done was difficult enough. If it weren't for Doug Stavanger's help, I wouldn't have been able to do it. It might be just a random mutation, said the doctor, trying to look optimistic. Or perhaps there was some chromosomal damage due to the zygote's long immersion in liquid nitrogen. We just don't know enough about the long-term effects of cryogenic temperatures. It's the drugs, she knew. All those years and all those uppers and aphrodisiacs and designer specials. They must have done the damage, carried to the poor, helpless embryo through my bloodstream. My son will pay for my weakness. So the baby will be born with chronic anemia, Amanda thought. Martin will just have to accept that. He'll be unhappy about it, but he'll have to accept it. As long as he believes it's his son, he'll do whatever is necessary for the baby. The doctor had hesitated and stammered until he finally worked up the courage to suggest, "There's nanotechnology, of course, should you choose to use it. It's banned on Earth, and I couldn't recommend it there. But here on the moon, you might be able to use nanotherapy to correct the baby's faulty gene. And your own." Amanda thanked him for being so open, but she knew that nanotherapy was impossible for her. Martin would find out about it. Not even Doug Stavanger could keep it a secret if she went to the nanotech lab in Cellini. The news that Martin Humphrey's wife wanted nanotherapy for her unborn child would flash to Martin's ears with the speed of light. The only nanotechnologist Amanda could trust was Chris Cardenas, and she'd been living in Ceres for years in self-imposed exile from Cellini. Now she was on the Saturn mission, going even farther away. No. Nanotherapy is out, Amanda swiftly decided. I've got to handle this without using nanotech. I've got to protect my baby, she said to herself as she lay in the darkness next to her sleeping, dreaming husband. I've got to protect him from Martin. Which means that I've got to live through the birth. Unconsciously, Amanda clenched her fists. Women don't die in childbirth. That hasn't happened in years, not in a century or more. Not in a modern medical facility. Not even women with weak hearts. She had known that the years of living in low-gravity environments had taken a toll on her heart. All those years living on Ceres, practically zero gravity. Even here on the moon, it's only 1/6 G. Bad for the heart. Deconditions the muscles. It's so easy to enjoy low G and let yourself go. Amanda had exercised regularly, mainly to keep her figure. Martin had married a beautiful woman, and Amanda worked hard over the years to remain youthfully attractive. But it wasn't enough to strengthen her heart. Perhaps you should consider aborting this pregnancy, the doctor had suggested, as tentatively as a man suggesting heresy to a bishop. Work to get your heart into proper condition and then try to have a baby again. No, Amanda had replied softly. I can't do that. The doctor had thought she had religious scruples. I know abortion is a serious issue, he had told her, but even the Catholics permit it now. As long as it's not simply to terminate an illegitimate pregnancy, I can provide medical justification. Thank you, Amanda had said. But no, I can't. I see. The doctor had sighed like a patient father faced with an intractable child. All right. Then we can use an auxiliary heart pump during the delivery. It's very simple, he had explained. standard procedure. A temporary ventricular assist pump. A slim balloon on the end of a catheter is inserted into the femoral artery in the thigh and worked up into the lower aorta. It provides extra cardiovascular pumping power. Takes some of the workload off the heart during labor. Amanda had nodded. When I go for my prenatal checkup at the hospital here in Cellini, they'll find out about my heart and make the same recommendation. Martin will know about it, but that's perfectly all right. He'll call in the best cardiovascular experts. That's fine too, as long as no one realizes I've switched Martin's genetic profile for Lars's. That's what I've got to avoid. Martin thinks his genes are perfect. He's got a 6-year-old son to prove it. We've already done a genetic screen on me, of course. I passed that test. It's just the baby. My poor, helpless little baby that has a problem. I've got to make certain that Martin doesn't know. He mustn't find out. Amanda lay in her bed for hours while Humphreys thrashed and moaned in his sleep next to her. She stared at the darkened ceiling, watched the digital clock count the minutes and hours. At last, well after 4 a.m., still wide awake, she sat up and softly slipped out of bed. On bare feet, she tiptoed across the thick carpeting, past the lavatory, into the walk-in closet that was lined with the finest clothes money could buy. Only after she had gently closed the closet door did she grope for the light switch on the wall. Months earlier, she had disconnected the sensor that automatically turned on the overhead lights. Squinting in the sudden brightness, she stepped deeper into the closet, ignoring the gowns and frocks and slacks and precious blouses. She went to one of the leather handbags hanging in the rear of the closet, and, after rummaging in it for a few moments, came out with a handful of soft blue gelatin capsules. "Tranquilizers," Amanda told herself. "They're nothing more than good, strong tranquilizers. I need them if I want to get any sleep at all." She stared at the capsules in her palm. Her hand was shaking so hard she feared she would drop them. She closed her fingers around them. "They won't hurt the baby. They can't, that's what the chemist told me. And I need them. I need them badly."
Asteroid Vesta. Doric Harbin hid the discomfort he felt from all the others. But he could not hide it from himself. A man who preferred solitude, a lone wolf who tracked his prey silently, without help, he was now in command of nearly 500 men and women, mercenaries hired by Humphreys for the coming assault against Astro Corporation. Most of them were engineers and technicians, not warriors. They were building a base on Vesta, burrowing deep into the asteroid's rocky body, tunneling out hardened silos to hold missiles that could blast approaching ships out of the sky. Harbin remembered HSS's first attempt to build a base on Vesta's surface. Fuchs had wiped it out with a single blow, dropping a freighter's load of asteroidal ores that smashed buildings and people in a deadly avalanche of falling rocks. "So now we dig," Harbin said to himself, as he glided down one of the dusty tunnels toward the smoothed-out cave that would be his headquarters. He wore a real uniform now, complete with epaulets on his shoulders and an uncomfortable high choke of a collar, and insignias of rank. Harbin was a colonel now, with 4 pointed stars at his throat and cuffs to show it. The emblems disturbed Harbin. They reminded him of crosses. He'd seen too many crosses over the years, in churches and more often in cemeteries. Humphreys paid someone to design these stupid uniforms, he knew. He also knew that a man's ability to command comes from what is in his head and in his guts, not from fancy uniforms and polished boots. "But Humphreys pays the bills," Grigor constantly reminded him. "And Humphreys is in a sweat to complete this base and begin the assault that will wipe Astro out of the belt." "But Fuchs is still out there, somewhere, hiding himself deep in the dark emptiness of the belt. It's a mistake to stop hunting him," Harbin thought. "Humphreys thinks that once he's eliminated Astro, Fuchs will fall into his lap easily enough. But I wonder. The man is wily, tough, a survivor. He's dangerous. Too dangerous to be permitted to live."